What am I doing here?
Okay, I'm going to call to order this special meeting of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. It is March 7th, 2017.
And I'm going to call to order the special meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee.
So for us on the Senate side, we do not have a quorum present. So under committee rules, I am assigning myself and the other member present to receive public testimony on behalf of that august body, the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. So I think I'm actually going to have, I think Ken is going to lead tonight's meeting. But I just want to say before we get started, thank you all who are here in person or following us online for this first in a series of informational meetings that we're holding, following up on our public hearing last week where we opened and heard all the bills related to climate that we have before us this session. It was very clear after that hearing, and it became clearer for me after I read all the public testimony, that we have a lot of work to do. There are a lot of questions out there and a lot of information that we need to seek and that we need to get in order to come up with how best to address this problem in a way that will be best for Oregon. So we're starting starting the series with tonight's program. We're just going to have a focus on the business case for dealing with the problem of greenhouse gas emissions. And let me say that, colleagues, one of the other reasons that we're doing this is we had a great hearing last week. We heard from a lot of people. But because there were so many people, we didn't have time to ask questions of our witnesses, people coming to give testimony. That does not hold for tonight. And so I welcome your questions, and this is our chance to pick the brains of experts who will be coming before us on a variety of issues, subjects over the next weeks. Those are my kind of preparatory remarks.
Yeah, I'd like to also extend my welcome to all of you and folks who are viewing from home. We were lucky enough to work this type of meeting into the type of meeting that can qualify to be posted on OLIS, and therefore the audio video is also working for folks at home, and materials are posted on OLIS as well that pertain to this meeting. It's my hope that by the end of the week we'll be able to give you the rest of the schedule of the meetings that will occur and at least a topical area that we'll be covering, if not the speakers as well. It's our intent to have a very broad discussion about both how a carbon trading system could work for Oregon, how it might connect to California if we so choose, what other parts of a program we might want to have in the state, since we have abundant natural resources that actually sequester carbon for us naturally, and then what other pieces, parts we might need to make a complete package. So I don't know whether we'll be able to get all that done in just four Tuesdays, but we'll be trying to do that. Before we start the rest of the meeting, I need for my committee, and I am very pleased with my committee members tonight. Thank you for so many of you being here. You're making us look good on our side. We had a bill.
We were just making sure there were seats for you.
Mm-hmm. What we need to do real quick, though, as a matter of a strange quirk of procedural rules on the House side, is to carry over from our last House E&E meeting a work session on House Bill 2331 to tomorrow's agenda, March 8th, 2017. So that bill is now carried over. What we have on tap tonight is informational hearings on an overview of the risky business report. And for that, Jana, are you going to provide us with an overview?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I think it, I think it would be a good idea for me to express my reason for being here, because I don't want it to be misconstrued as supporting necessarily a carbon trading program, a cap and trade program, or any other program. I'm here in for many reasons, but one of them is to listen carefully and to see what sort of concepts you may be considering, and also to make it clear when given the opportunity that whatever these different programs might be, they may not be the answer. So I think the remarks made earlier by Senator Dimbrough were correct in that we are seeking the proper form of a response, and my participation in this meeting does not mean that I in any way support a cap and trade system or something of that nature. But I'm very interested in knowing more about them, and particularly the credit market piece, and I welcome the opportunity to learn more. One other point, and that is I've seen from last year ago in February the assertion made that because of hearings held like this, we didn't have to hold hearings during the short session. And I would strongly suggest that, this hearing not be used in that fashion. And if there is a decision to bring legislation of some nature in the 2018 session, that we don't cut short the type of hearings that would need to be held in that session, pointing at this one. I just want to make that clear, because I don't think that would be fair, right, or, and I think I suggested that during the year ago meetings. So having made those 2 points, I look forward to the testimony.
And I appreciate you being here, Representative Benz.
Yes, thank you for those comments. And I think many of you, just for myself, I've never been accused of cutting meetings short, I think, or not holding meetings. So we intend this process to be fully engaging and ongoing. And as we are refining our schedule, we intend to rely heavily on our vice chairs for input in speakers, and just, you know, we want to make sure that the questions that are out there, we're providing an arena for those questions to get answered.
I should probably have, I got ahead of myself, and I should probably extend the same courtesy to the rest of the committee members. If you have any similar statement to Representative Benz about why you're here, what your interest is, if we could do that quickly, I'd appreciate it, but I'd be happy to provide that opportunity. Okay. Very good. Now we can move into the substance. We have Jameson Rogers Gibson from the Union of Concerned Scientists on the phone to present an overview of the Risky Business Report. And we also have, okay. That's for the next one.
Yeah, but he's.
And so, Jameson, I'll let you go ahead and give your own introduction and overview of what you'll be covering. Janice here, and she has your PowerPoint in front of us now.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And then I'd like to thank you, Chairman Dimbrough, and you, Chairman Helm, for the opportunity to brief you and your fellow committee members today on the Risky Business Project and the cost of inaction on climate change. My name is Jameson Rogers Gibson, and I currently work for the Union of Concerned Scientists as the Western State Senior Climate Analyst. But prior to that, I was the project manager for the Risky Business Project from 2013 to 2015. So I'll be presenting on that inaugural Risky Business Project today. And the key takeaway that I'd like to leave you with today from the inaugural report is that our economy is vulnerable to a significant and diverse number of risks due to climate change, and remaining on the current greenhouse gas emissions path will only make these risks worse and more expensive. However, if we act today, we can avoid some of the worst impacts and most severe risks, but only if we start changing our business and public policy decisions today. Next slide. So just some background on the project. The Risky Business Project is a nonpartisan research effort that's focused specifically on the economic risks and opportunities of climate change. And it's chaired by former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, former Mayor of New York City Mike Bloomberg, and former hedge fund manager and philanthropist Tom Steyer. As successful businessmen, these three men understand the need to assess the various risks facing their investments. And they view climate change as one of the greatest threats to the economy, both here in the US and also globally. For instance, rising temperatures and sea levels and changing precipitation patterns due to a changing climate will impact the performance of many long-term investments being made today, such as mortgages, bonds for public infrastructure, and energy infrastructure investments, to name a few. The founders joined together in 2013 to initiate the Risky Business Project in order to develop a sound risk assessment on the impacts of a changing climate on key sectors of the economy, and then to engage leaders in the business and financial sectors in a discussion on their findings and how to address these risks. The three founders recruited additional leaders to form the project's risk committee, leaders who were similarly concerned about the economic future of America under the threat of global climate change. And they've spent the past couple of years traveling the country, engaging business and financial leaders on their climate risks. In fact, towards the early part of the project, Hank Paulson met with business leaders in Oregon through the Oregon Business Council and a crowd of over 500 people at the City Club of Portland. And this demonstrates that there is a real interest in having this discussion in Oregon. Next slide. In addition to the two co-chairs, the risk committee members are pictured here on the slide, and they include two former U.S. Treasury secretaries, four former CEOs and chairs of the boards of major corporations like Cargill, Walmart, Caterpillar, and Xerox, a former senator, a former mayor and secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and two leaders from the health sector. Together, they truly represent a nonpartisan group and include even leaders from previous administrations on both the Republican and Democratic side, and represent the regions and sectors that the project evaluated. Next slide. The Risk Committee commissioned the Rhodium Group, an economic research firm specializing in global disruptive trends, to conduct an independent national risk assessment of the impacts of climate change if we continue on a business as usual pathway between now and 2100. They convened a first-rate team of climate scientists and modelers, economists, as well as private sector risk assessors from RMS. And because our audience was the business and financial sectors, they used a classic business risk assessment approach to find out where the greatest risks lie. Once businesses understand their risks, they can start incorporating them into their business decisions to minimize the risks, and also price them accordingly in their internal operations. The biggest determinant of a business's climate risk is where they do business. So the research team analyzed the risks of climate change from higher temperatures and changing precipitation to rising sea levels and greater storm damage at the regional scale. They looked at three major economic sectors: energy, coastal infrastructure, and commodity agriculture. And they also looked at the overarching issues of health and labor productivity. So in this way, it's not a comprehensive evaluation, but rather provides an approach that can be applied to other sectors. And I'd also just like to note that the research team took an interdisciplinary approach that, for the first time, combined the best available climate science projections through 2100 with historical impact data or econometric data and private sector modeling to project financial risk. The entire approach was peer-reviewed by leading climate scientists and economists. Next slide. So I'll briefly provide the national perspective on the risk assessment, which was the focus of the Risky Business Report. And my colleague Bob O'Keefe will do a deeper dive on the Oregon-specific economic risks. We found that if we remain on our current emissions pathway, the U.S. economy will face not just one, but many significant economic risks from climate change over the coming decades, and no region will be left untouched. The costs of inaction are significant. For example, rising seas and greater coastal storm damage threaten the financial value and the viability of properties and infrastructure along the coast. Increasing the value of existing property that sits below sea level nationwide from $66 to $106 billion in 2050 to $238 to $507 billion in 2100. In addition, that average number of days above 95 degrees Fahrenheit will increase dramatically, with impacts on labor productivity as some regions get too hot for people to work outside during parts of the day, not to mention the increased strain on the energy system and health costs. And some regions of the country will also likely experience significant losses in their annual crop yields without adaptation. Next slide. I'll touch very briefly upon some of our findings for Oregon. As I mentioned, Bottle Peak will provide a more in-depth discussion on the climate risk to Oregon. One of the things that we found was that Oregon will experience an almost eightfold increase in the number of days above 95 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. And for reference, this is equal to the number of days in Texas right now that are above 95 degrees Fahrenheit. While we didn't quantify this impact, we identified a study that showed significant potential increases in the burn areas due to wildfire in the western United States, with the forests in the Pacific Northwest and Rocky Mountains likely experiencing the greatest increases in annual burn area. And the Risky Business Project did not examine, or I shall say quantify, some of the most serious risks to Oregon, as these were outside of the scope of the analysis. But nevertheless, they are vital to Oregon's business community and way of life. And they include decreased snowpack, water availability, and drought, which together threaten summer water supplies, shellfish hatcheries failing because of acidifying oceans, and extreme events that are wreaking havoc on the tourism industry. In addition, Oregon businesses will be impacted by the ripple effects of climate change throughout the economy, as their supply chains that go beyond the state's borders are affected. As we like to say in the project, it's just because it's not hot where you are, it doesn't mean you won't feel the heat of climate change. And for instance, we saw this with Nike, who has recently changed its practices due to issues with its supply chain, like droughts overseas impacting its cotton supply and the 2013 floods in Thailand forcing a temporary closure of several of its factories. Next slide. So the good news is that if we take immediate action to act on climate change through early investments in climate preparedness and resilience, as well as action to reduce greenhouse gases, we can reduce the worst risks. For example, our research found that modest global emissions reductions can avoid up to 80% of the projected economic costs resulting from increased heat-related mortality and energy demand. We need to take action today to bend the emissions curve as shown on the slide. We also know that other impacts over the next several decades, such as sea level rise, are basically locked in by past emissions, so we'll need to adapt to those, but there are limits to adaptation. Both adaptation and mitigation will be critical, and in fact, we need to adapt to the risks that we cannot mitigate and mitigate to avoid the risks that we can't adapt to. Next slide. Through our interactions over the past few years, we've seen many businesses taking up this call to arms to consider their climate risk and help lead the way in reducing these risks through early investments in resilience and efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We've seen far-sighted businesses taking steps today to short their supply chains and physical infrastructure to guard against disruption from the extreme heat and weather events that are the hallmark of a changing climate, like Colgate closing or relocating 60 manufacturing sites that were at risk of severe weather. And we've seen others recognizing the need to reduce greenhouse gases to minimize their risk and also take advantage of the business opportunities that are there in the clean energy economy, like Hewlett-Packard announcing its plans to buy 112 megawatts from a wind farm in Texas to power all its data centers. And you know, here in Oregon, the clean energy sector is worth over $7 billion and growing quickly. At the same time, this is not a problem that the private sector alone can solve. It's critical that business and government work together, and the work of these committees is incredibly important. As Bob Rubin so eloquently puts it on the slide, we don't face a choice between our economy and the environment. They're inextricably linked, and the cost of inaction outweigh the cost of reducing greenhouse gases. We've seen in other states, like California and elsewhere, that it is indeed possible to successfully decouple greenhouse gas emissions from economic growth. We know that Oregon is already taking aggressive actions to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions and prepare for a warmer climate. But there's more work to be done, and there's a real opportunity to continue to be a climate leader. So I urge you to take the next necessary steps this legislative session to help address these risks and set Oregon on the path to a low-carbon economy. Thank you very much, and I am available for questions.
Questions from folks?
I have a question. Thank you very much for that presentation, Jameson. Can you say something about the ongoing work of the Risky Business Project? This was
sure. So, the Risky Business Project had its inaugural report that it released, which was the national assessment looking at different regions. We then produced a report focused on the Midwest in particular. Following up on that, we did a California-specific report, which I was the lead author for. And lastly, there was a report focusing on the climate risks to the southeastern portion of the United States. At that point, the risk committee members decided to turn towards, after having a lot of conversations and about climate risk and seeing that many businesses were starting to take this on, they decided to turn their attention to a discussion about how to address these risks, and particularly looking at the clean energy economy and what needs to happen to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions significantly enough to avoid the worst risks. And so they released a report in December focusing on the opportunities in the clean energy economy. And since I was not involved in that, I cannot speak to the particular nuances or findings of that report. But if you are interested, I would be more than happy to connect you with someone who is a lead author on that.
Thank you.
I have a question. Jameson, you mentioned that you were one of the lead authors on the impacts in California.
Yes.
Can you summarize some of the what you might think are some of the similarities in the impacts in that state as compared to Oregon? I mean, I can think. For example, since we both share a coastline with the Pacific Ocean, that some of the high water events or those types of things would be similar.
Mm-hmm. Sure. In addition to impacts of sea level rise, we in California also saw that there will be significant increases in temperature. The degree to which those increases happen varies across the state. And as a result of that, we did a review of the literature, because here in the Risky Business overall approach does not look explicitly at water availability and drought. So we did a literature review of that and talked to several of the leading scholars on the topic and included a write-up of the current state of knowledge on that. And so, as you know, California has had a very long-standing drought that we are now having be followed by one of our wettest winters on record. And so I would say drought and water availability and a decreasing snowpack is something that California also shares with Oregon in terms of concerns about water availability. And another concern that, or another climate risk that will impact both significantly is that of forest fires. Once again, that was not something that we quantified in the Risky Business Project, but we looked at the literature and saw that that was a significant risk for California. And we know it's a very significant risk for Oregon as well. Towards the end of the century, both states will also see a drop in labor productivity among the particularly high-risk sectors of employment. And looking at Oregon, the percent of its workforce that fits into that high-risk category for reductions in labor productivity in 2011 was about 35%. So that is another impact that we quantify that both do share.
If I could follow up real quick, and then I have a couple more questions here. Did the California report look at impacts on agriculture as a result of the temperatures increase?
It did. One of the Risky Business Project, in terms of that agriculture piece, focused exclusively in terms of quantifying the benefits on four commodity crops. So cotton, wheat, corn, and soy. And for California, the majority of our agriculture is focused in specialty crops. Mm-hmm. So we did see some impacts due to higher temperatures and changing precipitation in the commodity crops in California, where we saw potentially the biggest impacts for agriculture in California is related to specialty crops. So our fruits and vegetables and wine industry. And so since we did a California-specific report, we really dove into those, and we saw that there will be some rather significant impacts. One thing I should note is that in our analysis, we did not take into account potential adaptation by the agricultural sector. And so that is an area that can, of course, help buffet some of these potential climate risks. And our analyses also for agriculture don't necessarily take into account some of the severe changes in water availability. And so that is something else that the estimates and the impacts that we have in the report, if you take that into account, they would be considered rather conservative, and you might anticipate seeing even more serious impacts if that's taken into account.
Thank you. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, and thank you for being here by phone. A question that I have, sure. you mentioned that slight changes to great changes in the reduction of greenhouse gases showed significant in your chart changes in the future risk. You talked about adaptation, but you didn't list any kinds of things. Was there conversations about what kinds of adaptations affected different sectors?
Sure. And do you mean types of adaptation that we looked at in our analysis?
Yes.
So for the Risky Business Project, one of our goals was to provide business and financial leaders with information that they could use to better integrate climate risk into their decisions. And from that perspective, that was looking at them responding from both a climate resilience perspective, but also realizing that ultimately, in order to avert the worst risks, we need to be focusing on greenhouse gas reductions. And so in order to inform those decisions, we modeled a variety of greenhouse gas reduction paths, or I should say a variety of greenhouse gas emission scenarios. And we also specifically did not model adaptation. And so that is something that could be considered in looking at these numbers. Of course, adaptation measures also have a variety of costs associated with them, some quite significant as well. So that was something generally to think about in terms of the cost of inaction and the cost of action.
Senator Dimbrough.
Yeah, thanks. So going back to the reduction part of this, as you mentioned, the way to address reduction needs to be a kind of a partnership between private enterprise and government. Does Risky Business have particular recommendations to government, i.e. to us, about which, what the best paths are to reduction? I mean, one of the things that we're wrestling with here as a group is we've been presented with a number of reduction strategy paths, carbon tax, cap and trade, cap and invest, just a number of different things. Are there specific courses of action that the Risky Business Risk Committee or whoever would be the appropriate body is recommending to groups like us?
Sure. While I can't speak necessarily for the Risky Business Project currently in terms of what the particular actions that they are asking governments to take, what I can speak to is some of the actions that I am aware of in terms of individual risk committee members and what they have focused on. And so I know that there are several risk committee members that have expressed strong support for putting a price on carbon. And several have come forward focusing on particular mechanisms for that, but overall have really strongly encouraged that the public sector put a price on carbon to help provide certainty for businesses to plan on this issue and also to help them to better incorporate some of these external costs into the way that they do business and to help them to better consider and integrate climate risk. There also have been other efforts that they've done in terms of having more climate risk disclosure, so encouraging that. And I know that Mayor Bloomberg has been involved in an international project related to that and how to better incorporate climate change into risk considerations. And I am also aware that several of the risk committee members have recently been to DC and have been involved in an effort there in regards to a carbon tax. So what I can confidently say is that among the members that I did mention that there is agreement that there needs to be a price placed on carbon. The Risky Business Project also released their report in December that focuses on a clean energy economy. So that I'd be happy to follow up with you and send that report as additional material. It's not my expertise, and I was not involved in that particular effort, so I won't be able to speak to that. But they definitely were describing the need to decarbonize the economy.
Any further questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Chair. I guess a point and then a question. We're being encouraged to move on to a clean energy economy, but I guess I just would recall or make us recall the legislation we passed the last two sessions, i.e. clean fuels, followed by Senate Bill 1547, the coal to clean bill, which I think a lot of us supported. Some of that because we felt it put us on a clean energy economy pathway, so there can be differing opinions about just how far we need to go, but I think the record should show that we have taken some pretty dramatic actions already. I guess my question for our guest would be, what direct linkage could you make or can you make between us accomplishing or realizing Oregon's climate goals, which as I talk about CO2 emissions, which I think are pretty ambitious, in measurable impacts to our climate, if we're successful in reaching our carbon emissions goals, what kind of assurance can you give us that we're going to see a measurable impact on Oregon's climate?
Could you hear that question, Jameson?
I could not.
Okay. Mark, could you restate that?
Certainly. Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay. My question is about, what kind of direct linkage can your organization give us here in Oregon if we accomplish our carbon reduction goals, CO2 reductions, which are pretty ambitious, and there's actually a bill that would even ratchet that up even further. What direct linkage can you give us between accomplishing those goals and direct measurable impact to Oregon's climate?
Oregon's climate goals are consistent. The climate goals under consideration are consistent with the goals that many different nations have agreed to in terms of agreeing to the Paris Accord. And there's a lot of momentum around those goals, and so Oregon has a real opportunity to show leadership on this issue and at the same time to take advantage of the business opportunities that come forward with trying to achieve these goals and realizing a lot of benefits both within Oregon from an economic perspective as well as a health perspective. And so by Oregon seeking to meet these goals and being part of the international momentum around this and exerting its leadership, I think that there is a real opportunity there. And if Oregon fails, all of us are in this together. There are over 190 countries that have agreed to this and a lot of sub-nationals as well through the under two MOU. And so if Oregon fails at meeting its goals, it increases the risks for everyone else.
Follow up. So I appreciate that, but I guess what I hear you saying is that any measurable impact on our state's climate is going to be dependent upon the rest of the world's response. Is that correct?
Of course.
Meaning unilaterally, we're not going to forestall any of the dire consequences that you predict. It's dependent upon the world responding in like fashion. Is that correct?
I would say that achieving Oregon's climate goals alone won't change Oregon's climate, but participation in national and international efforts will. And Oregon will also get ahead from economic development and investment in greenhouse gas reduction projects. So you could say that every province or state is too small to matter, but each one really does matter.
Representative Reske, did you have a question?
No, it was Brocksmith.
Brocksmith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chairs. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Great. My question is Oregon's climate goals currently, how do they compare with the other states in the nation? Are we already leading by example?
I am not explicitly familiar with Oregon's existing climate goals. What I can say is that Oregon has shown a lot of leadership in the area of climate change, from passing the Clean Fuels Program to its bill to clean on clean electricity and coal. And from the UCF perspective, the next logical step for Oregon is to move forward and put a price on carbon. And also to place an enforceable cap on emissions in the state.
But we're already being the leader. Thank you for the follow-up, Mr. Chair. But we're already leading the nation in goals. My question kind of goes back to Representative Johnson's question. And can you tell us what what Oregon's total emissions are versus on the global scale of things as far as a percentage?
I'm not familiar with the exact percent. What I can share is that in terms of your last question with Oregon and its climate goals, there was a recent report that came out that highlighted that Oregon is in fact increasing its emissions and will not meet its 2020 target based on its current policies. However, Oregon would be a leader if it were able to achieve the reductions.
Any further? Representative Holden.
Thanks. I'm not sure she can hear me from down here. Thank you. My question is more about the have you done any analysis about the I guess cost to the economy from creating a price on carbon versus the cost to the economy for not addressing the emissions?
Are you referring to whether the Risky Business Project has done that type of analysis?
Right. I was just kind of curious about what the cost to the economy for adopting a price on carbon, and you know, whatever price that happens to be, to achieve the emissions reductions to get us in a comfortable zone, I suppose, versus the cost to the economy for not doing that.
Sure. So I'm not aware of an analysis that the Risky Business Project has specifically done on that. But what I can share is that a carbon pricing policy is helpful in creating a cost-effective mechanism to incorporate the costs of climate change into business decisions and at the same time, so that a lot of the climate impacts that I discussed and many more that were not included in the Risky Business Project can be better considered in the decisions of businesses, as well as the opportunities that are presented for a clean energy economy. And at the same time, a price on carbon is also helpful in that it can help fund, it creates revenue. So it can also help fund the transition to a clean energy economy, as well as helping to provide protection for low-income families and impacted workers and help with the transition for impacted workers, as well as helping to improve the livelihoods of underserved and rural communities.
Thank you. Jameson, thank you. We're going to move along in our agenda now, but we really appreciate you giving us an overview of the risky business analysis on such short notice. So thanks again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And next up on our agenda is an overview of the E2 report, and we have Bob O'Keefe on the line. Bob, are you still there?
I am. Thank you very much.
Good. We're going to team you up with Mike Mercer, who is in the room here with us. And so, Mike, is there a PowerPoint that you have?
I think it should be.
Okay. We're getting the PowerPoint loaded up right now.
Great.
And all of our committee members have a copy of the Oregon E2 report with them right now. All right, the PowerPoint is up, and I think you can go ahead anytime.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman, I should say, and members of the committee. Thanks so much for letting me participate tonight, and of course, feel free to holler out if you can't hear me very well or if there's an audio problem, and I'll do what I can do about it. And apologies that I cannot be there in person, but I will go to bed happy tonight with the realization that lawmakers in the great state of Oregon are working well into the night, I guess, on addressing some of the most important issues of our generation, including protecting our environment and also growing our economy. So, as mentioned, I'm Bob Keefe. I'm the executive director of E2, or Environmental Entrepreneurs. We're a national, nonpartisan group of business owners, investors, and others who advocate for policies that are good for both the economy and good for the environment. We got our start about 17 years ago in California when we started working on what then were the first auto emission standards in the country, in the world, really. And that was a time when when the California legislature was debating an issue not too much unlike this one, and our founders and their friends and businesses across the state met with lawmakers to start to discuss the jobs, the innovation, the fuel efficiency, as well as the environmental benefits that can come with doing something to build cars that produce less pollution and go further on a gallon of gas. So next slide, if you will. Since those days, E2 has grown to about 850-900 members nationwide. We're spread across 9 chapters, stretching from Oregon and the Pacific Northwest to New York City and Boston. Our members have founded or funded about 2,500 companies, created about 600,000 jobs, and control about $100 billion in venture and private equity capital. These folks include everybody from real estate developers and serial entrepreneurs in places like Portland and Bend to mom-and-pop solar installers in the middle of Iowa and hotel chain operators and Boston and real estate execs in New York City. So we do advocacy, we do research, we do events using those business voices or amplifying those business voices that are our members. E2 is an affiliate of NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, which guides us with our policy and our other work. So what these members, our E2 members, have in common, these business members, is that they realize that the economy and the environment are not at odds. But in fact, smart environmental policies ranging from limiting those car emissions down in California to the cap and invest programs like you're considering, to help the economy and drive innovation, drive investment, create jobs. Now, as you all know and have heard already, other business groups look at the costs of environmental policies because they have to watch out for their businesses and their members and their industries, and that's okay. That's what they do. E2, we are not a trade group. We're not an industry group. We're a broad group of business people and investors like the ones I mentioned. And so we look at a broader vision, if you will, of environmental policies and look to the economic benefits that can accrue to the economy from smart environmental policies. Next slide, please. So for the past several years, E2 has been looking very closely at the economic benefits of smart, clean energy and climate policies all around the country. We've produced a whole bunch, as my staff will tell you, way too many reports on everything from clean energy jobs to economic costs and benefits of specific state policies all across the country. So a year ago, we produced something that we call the Oregon Report that you'll see there in front of you right there, and hopefully you have in your hands right now, that looked at the costs and the benefits of addressing or ignoring climate change in the great state of Oregon. Now, to be clear, this wasn't data that we came up with. This was data taken from a wide variety of sources and compiled by us into this report. Those sources range include everything from the risky business report that Jameson just so kindly told us all about, to data from the University of Oregon, to the National Climate Assessment, state economic data, and a wide variety of other sources. What we wanted to do by compiling all these disparate and different sources was sort of paint a picture of the economic benefits and the costs of legislation like you're considering tonight. So the bottom line of what we found, gentlemen and ladies, was that not addressing climate change will cost Oregon billions of dollars in economic costs. Jameson laid that out to us. What we also found is that addressing climate change, especially through increasing clean energy, will create jobs, drive economic growth, and add billions potentially to the state's economy. So to get to this conclusion, we looked at five broad and specific areas. We looked at outdoor recreation. We looked at agriculture, we looked at transportation, we looked at energy costs, and we looked at coastal and timber impacts. And let me run through now, if I could, some of what we found. And if you could go to the next slide, please. In outdoor recreation, so one of the first areas we looked at. As we all know, Oregon has a huge outdoor rec industry. It generates about $12.8 billion in consumer spending. About 141,000 direct jobs. If we don't do anything to address climate change in the future, projections indicate that we'll have about 125 million in snow-based business losses by 2014, 266 million in angling. That's a lot of sea lift tickets and trout fishing licenses over those years that are at risk and a significant portion of the state's economy. Next slide, please. We next looked at agriculture. Oregon's agriculture sector contributes about $5.4 billion annually to the economy. Because of things like water shortages and rising temperatures, that's going to cause losses on farms and at cattle and dairy production operations. We've seen, according to other studies, that we can expect production losses of $11 million annually in cattle and calves alone, which, by the way, I believe is the number one commodity in Oregon right now. Increasing temperatures is going to cost farmers dearly, about $62 million annually by 2080. Next slide, please. Now, we looked also at transportation. And I don't know how many of you all have gotten stuck on the I-5 going south. But if you get stuck on, if you close the five for 24 hours, it costs the state about $7.5 million in lost commerce. When the five closes because of landslides or because of rock slides or flooding, that's a huge hit to the state's economy. And you can see the current backlog of Oregon's landslide repairs, which you all know a lot better than I do, is pretty significant, about $780 million, I believe. Next slide, please. So energy and energy costs is something else we looked at. So if you remember, obviously, over the past couple of summers in Oregon and also in California and other parts of the country, it was mighty hot. Increased air conditioning costs from climate change-related issues will amount to about $37 million more out of consumers' pockets by 2040. That's money that can't be reinvested into the economy on other stuff. That's just going up in smoke when Oregonians turn on their air conditioners to cool things down. Energy costs will also increase because of the reduction in hydropower that accompanies a reduction in water. Next slide, please. Coast and timber, or as some call it, surf and turf. Sea level rise and fiercer storms will result in an estimated $35 million annually in property damage along the Oregon coast. Wildfires and other climate-related timber losses could cost the state somewhere between $2.8 and $3.5 billion annually. And then there's the salmon industry. It's right square in the middle of all of this. By 2040, the state's economy could take about a billion-dollar hit annually just because of declining salmon habitat. Next slide, please. So, those are the problems. That's the scary stuff. And those are the big areas only. They don't cover other impacts that are measurable, but perhaps not included in this report. Everything from the ocean acidification impacts on the oyster business in Oregon, or lost work days and school days because of increased severe weather, for example. But what about the solutions? So we know from our work across the country over the past 17 years that smart policies create jobs, drive economic growth. And one of the best policies we know of is our policies that offset climate costs and address climate change by increasing clean energy, reducing the state's dependence on fossil fuels. Clean energy jobs right now are growing twice as fast in Oregon as the rest of the state's job base. Wow. By the way, you get about three times as many jobs out of clean energy investments than you do out of fossil fuel industry investments.
And we don't have any of that. So
next slide, please. So the good news is, as they like to say, that Oregon has a great base on which to build. This is data that you'll see that came from a Department of Energy energy jobs report that came out in January. Right now, about 42,000 Oregonians work in energy efficiency, about 7,000 in solar, more than 1,000 in wind, 6,400 in energy storage, smart grid, and related other clean energy ventures. That's a lot of jobs and something to grow off of. So, in conclusion, I'd make three points. First of all, and this is what you all are grappling with and debating right now, Oregon could do nothing about these issues. What we know is, from what we've seen from other research reports and what we've just heard about in the risky business reports, doing nothing poses significant risk to the Oregon economy. Everything from coastal property damage to timber losses to loss of salmon habitat, the fewer cattle production in the state. Second thing, you can do something about this. You can take steps to reduce and cap greenhouse gases. You can take investments from that and invest in things like clean energy. What we know from our work across the state is that investing in clean energy creates jobs, drives economic growth, drives innovation, and increases investments in the state. So the last thing I'd say is that what you all already know, and that's that Oregon has a real opportunity right now, and a strong base on which to build, to continue to be a national leader on clean energy and climate change at a time when the country suddenly and really does find itself lacking in leadership, at least on the federal level, on clean energy and climate change issues. You all are sandwiched in between great states and provinces that are already leading the country and in many cases the world on these issues. Oregon has the opportunity here to stay solemnly a part of that leadership, reap the benefits that come with clean energy jobs, clean energy investments. or deal with the costs of continued climate change issues. So that's all I have for you. Thanks so much again for letting me speak to you, and I'm here for questions, but we'll probably defer to smarter guys like Mike Mercer.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. Questions? Mike, did you have anything to add?
No, I think I just let Bob's testimony.
Really stand. Good at pushing the button.
Thank you. It was a tough job. Somebody had to do it.
And can you just, for our record, state your name?
Sure, it's Mike Mercer.
And any questions from members? Representative Brock Smith.
Yes. So,
to either Mike or Bob.
I think we're directing them to Bob, but if Bob defers back to me, then.
Okay. So we might want to get that mic close again.
Well, it's just a. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, the question is the same question that Representative Johnson asked our former presenter with regards to Oregon's total emissions and how it compares to on the global scale. And so if Oregon were to reduce its emissions to zero, would it have a noticeable effect on Oregon's climate?
Well, look, we all know that Oregon can't do this alone. Oregon's not going to change the climate in the rest of the planet. And we, as Jameson and others have said, we obviously are all in this together, and we have to rely on other jurisdictions, whether they states, regions, countries, to do the right thing as well. What Oregon can do by taking the right steps is send a clear market signal to businesses. And that market signal is that Oregon is open for business when it comes to clean energy, and that it's pursuing policies that will advance clean energy, which will lead to jobs, lead to investment, and lead to a better climate for all of us.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it wouldn't make a difference, is what you're saying, other than showing the rest of the world that Oregon is a leader, which we already are, and your testimony admitted that we are. And so my question is, then how can you say to us here in this panel, and I quote, doing nothing poses great risk to Oregon's economy, when if we were to reduce our carbon emissions to zero, it would not affect Oregon's climate change.
Oregon doing that by itself would not affect Oregon's climate. You are absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Oregon taking steps in concert with California, with British Columbia, with Washington State, with other jurisdictions on this half of the country. Oregon's leadership would send a signal to other states that, hey, if Oregon can do this, we can do this. Maybe we should take these steps as well. That's the leadership part of this, right? You send a signal to businesses that you're open for business for clean energy. You send a signal to other jurisdictions that we need to get on board here, and you can follow Oregon. Or you can be a part of the leadership here. That's what makes a difference.
Thank you.
In my opinion.
Senator Denbro.
Thanks. And thanks for that comment, Bob. This is a debate, I think, that we're probably going to have throughout this work on this issue, because I think it is a central one. And I think that you're pointing to, you know, the importance of states acting in concert with one another, acting regionally, is, I think, a very good one, particularly, as you mentioned, with, you know, what I predict will be a dearth of leadership on this issue from Washington, D.C. in the next period of time. You know, I do want to, I want to remind Representative Brock Smith, you know, what we heard earlier, and we, both committees, I think, heard from the Global Warming Commission, that is, we have as a state set very ambitious goals, but we're not meeting those goals. And we need to figure out how we get back on track in order to be able to meet those goals. We can set the most ambitious goals we want, but we need to reach them. And so I think that's a big part of what we're talking about here. One of the things that you learn the more that you're involved in this legislative business is how states sort of prod each other along, and that, you know, no state really acts in isolation. Even California, which sometimes seems like it acts in isolation, you know, the things that happen in one state affect momentum in other states. And so, you know, I do believe, you know, first of all, we as a state have to ask ourselves, can we ask other countries to be doing more than we are? If we don't step up to the plate and serve as models, then it's hard ethically, I think, for us to ask others to do that. But then in addition, I think it, you know, this notion of momentum creating really is a very important part of this. I'm sure we'll come back to this. I'm sure other members have thoughts about this as well.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I want to thank you for the work and for this pamphlet that we were given. It looks like it covers an enormous number of issues. One of the things that we know about climate change, greenhouse gas emissions, is that they very strongly interact with local conditions. For example, when a diesel truck emits the emissions that it emits, sorry, bad use of words, it puts out an enormous number of particles that cause asthma in kids, emphysema in old people, and a variety of other things. I didn't see anything in your materials today, and maybe it's left out on purpose, on the health costs of continuing to pollute in this way as compared to cleaning up diesel emissions, just as one example, and reducing the local pollution that occurs when we do that. Do you have any thoughts on that issue? I mean, it seems to me that that would be by itself a huge advantage to Oregon, regardless of whether the rest of the world deals with the issue or not.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that great question. The answer is there are a lot of other groups that have that are a lot smarter than me anyway, that have looked at the health costs of climate change and have a wide number of reports that show exactly what you say, is that it's a huge and growing cost to any economy. We didn't look at that just because we looked at the more business-focused economic impacts, if you will, and economic benefits.
And Mike Mercer has a comment. If you go to page 12, so we didn't look at it in great depth, but you will see some data in there around air pollution costs, extreme heat costs, and so forth, that are in a little smaller detail than some of the others, but we did capture a little bit of that info. Specific to diesel pollution, but larger greenhouse gas emissions.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I missed that. It's in the side note on page 12, and it actually shows a pretty good size cost.
Thank you. Bob, I have a question. E2 does work across the country, as you said, and so you have a view into what other states are doing and how far along they might be in creating a green energy economy and other economic activities that respond to climate change. And in business, there's often talk about first mover advantage when you're changing an industry or you're bringing forth a new product, so forth. Do you think that there's a first mover or an early mover advantage for Oregon in making this transition from a business perspective?
I think there absolutely is, and here's why I say that. When we look at the states that are leading this country in clean energy jobs, and there's, by the way, about 3 million people that work in clean energy right now in every state in the country, in between renewables like solar and wind and energy efficiency, and also in clean vehicles, for instance. So when we look across the country at the states that have the most clean energy jobs, it's clearly the states that have the best policies on clean energy and on climate change. So if you look in the Northeast, for instance, the REGI states, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative states up there, Massachusetts has more people that work in energy efficiency than just about any other state in the country outside of California. If you look at the state of California, for instance, we have more people that work in clean energy here, not just because there's a lot of sunshine, but because the state has the most aggressive and effective standards for renewable energy, for energy efficiency. And it's not necessarily the states that you think about all the time, by the way, or at least not ones that I think about all the time. If you look at a state like North Carolina, for instance, North Carolina is now the number third or fourth solar state in the country right now. Why is that? Because North Carolina is the only state in the Southeast that has a renewable portfolio standard. If you look at Iowa's got is one of the nation's biggest producers of wind energy. They've got to have windmills on their license plates now. Iowa wind is so important to that state. Why? Because Iowa had the first renewable portfolio standard in the country, which created a lot of jobs. It's driven a lot of economic growth there. So yes, by setting the policy that sends a signal to businesses that this is a place we want to expand, we want to grow. Yes, Oregon can and is a first mover already.
Further questions, folks? Rip Reske.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Bob and Mike, for your presentation. Would E2 be in favor of, suppose that coal could get to the point where it had zero or near zero emissions, would E2 be in favor of something like that?
Forgive me, would we be in favor of what had zero emissions?
I'm sorry, if... I'll speak up louder. If E2 would be in favor of if coal plants could get close to zero or near zero emissions, would E2 favor that as part of the portfolio mix of clean energy?
Well, I can tell you from E2's perspective, we don't pick winners and losers in energy. We do know that there's a lot more people that work in clean energy right now than the economic benefits as well as the environmental benefits of clean energy is a lot better than coal right now. If you can get coal to zero emissions, I don't know. We've never taken a position on any kind of energy, good, bad, or indifferent. We do know that some forms are better for the environment, of course, and we do know that some are better for jobs and investments.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Marsh.
I'll come down here. Yeah. So apropos of the last question regarding coal, would you say that is an advantage of a cap system in that it would impose a comprehensive standard that all sectors would simply have to aspire to in a non-judgmental fashion?
Well, I certainly appreciate the question. I profess that I'm probably not the right guy to talk about policy issues like that just because I don't know the specifics there. Sorry.
Okay. Further questions? Very good.
Well, Bob, we've reached the point where we've exhausted all the questions from the senators and representatives here. I'd like to thank you for taking time out of your evening to walk us through the report. In looking through it, it's a very impressive report, and I appreciate it. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. All right. We're at the point in the meeting where we can go to have dinner. Again, thank you all for both senators and representatives for taking time to be with us tonight.
Yeah, and let me make one further request to the members who are here. As Rep. Helms said, we are in the process this week of formulating the agenda, at least, you know, for the next four meetings. We're open to your requests. If you have issues that you want to make sure that we get covered here, please do reach out to us, and we're eager to incorporate them. And again, this is our chance to really dig deep and dive deep into these issues. So, with that, yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, yes. I appreciate that. I would like one of our meetings to look at the effect of forest fire on carbon emissions. Having been from a county that has dealt with probably one of the largest fires in the state of Oregon, the Biscuit Fire, and then, of course, it being in my district, all of it. I can't help but look at the relationship with forest management and utilizing timbers from forest management and the new budding cross-laminated timber industry, if you will, that we can sequester carbon in those ways for 100 years in buildings versus letting them burn up and then releasing that carbon in the atmosphere, which... You know, and is in the upwards of nationwide 300 million metric tons a year. And so if we can look at meeting our goals in comparison to management practices in our timberlands, I think that plus sequestering that carbon in wood products and buildings, I think it would be a very fruitful discussion.
Thank you for those comments, and that's such a good point that we're already working on it.
I figured it
would. And any other ideas, please work it through either Representative Johnson or your co-chair, co-vice chairs on the Senate side.
Yeah, and let me say just specifically to the points that you raised, Rep. Brocksmith, in the Senate committee on Monday, we are devoting our session to informational meetings on cross-laminated timber and on the forest collaboratives, you know, that are trying to sort of rejigger our relationship with federal forest lands and also, you know, others to come up with more sustainable harvesting that will allow us to increase our yield and really put it to productive use to put that carbon to good use, as you mentioned.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, I'm going to thank you all for being here tonight, and we will close the meeting.
Yep. The Senate committee is closed.
And the House Committee on Environment and Energy is adjourned. House Committee on Environment and Energy is adjourned.